It's just all about figuring out ways to improve over time. And sometimes some of the stuff you'll hear back will just be noise. There'll be two people that'll tell you to do the exact opposite thing. And that's common. But once you start hearing a lot of people saying the same thing, that's a good sign. And it's always good to just test.
You're listening to the Credit Union Leadership Podcast, a podcast that delivers value and offers up insight that'll help your credit union grow. ServiceStar has been consulting with credit unions for over 20 years, growing them in the areas of cultural development, leadership development, and management training. To learn more about what ServiceStar can do for you or your credit union, check them out at servicestarconsulting.com.
So this episode is for you and me. It's for specifically people who are in learning and development or HR, of how to teach in a way that is going to inspire your team. And then also for people that are on the floor, right? We're going to be talking about practical skills of what to do with one-on-ones or how to learn about your team to help them retain this information and put it to use, right, Albrecht?
It's going to be a great, great opportunity for you to level up your learning and development, either as a learning and development user or someone who creates learning and development training like Mr. Anderley and I.
Yeah. Let's get started.
Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Elliot Jardin.
Hey, thanks so much. Thanks for the warm introduction. And it's great to be here. I'm looking forward to talking about memory, attention, motivation, all the things that get people to learn and retain information.
So I believe that if somebody wanted to remember this podcast, I have to like hijack or I've got to get their amygdala kind of like excited, right? Like I gotta like do something to like, you know, get some blood flow, because a little bit of stress is good in a training environment. Can you talk about why we might have people stand up before an in-person class, or why we might have them fill in the blanks in a online live class? Like what's the science behind motion and stress and learning ability?
Oh, sure. So depending on what you're doing, it's great to just get started and get the blood flowing and get focused on what it is that you want to do. And there's a lot of different ways to motivate someone to move forward and continue. And stress is the body's natural reaction to something in the environment that kind of pushes us or challenges us. And under the right circumstances, stress can be really helpful for getting people engaged. However, chronic stress is actually pretty bad for long-term memories as a whole. So it's sort of a balance. One thing I would suggest is tailoring the learning activities around motivation so that it makes people want to be there and want to learn. There's several different types of motivation. There's motivation that's intrinsic in nature, where the people want to learn it, they find it interesting, they want to continue, and they're doing it for their own personal gain. And then there's also extrinsic motivation, where people are doing things because perhaps they want to get a promotion, they want to get a raise. And these types of motivating factors are a great way to get people engaged.
So like when I sneeze, it feels good. It's a little bit of a dopamine spike. Motivation provides some of those same chemicals to the brain, right? So if I'm internally motivated, I get a dopamine spike when I get something on the checklist checked off. If I'm externally motivated, it's providing that dopamine spike to be able to go and get after the prize. Could even be like, I'm going to get the highest points in a cahoots game in online learning. So as someone who actually teaches class and understands the components of the brain, what do you do to prep your students to be able to have the most optimal learning experience and retain as much as they can in the time that they have with you in class?
Right. So there's a lot of places to focus in on when it comes to learning. And you've highlighted two of them. One was the amygdala to get started, which is part of the emotional center in the brain, which is connected to another part of the brain, which is really important for creating new memories, which is called the hippocampus. And the hippocampus lives in this area called the limbic system, which is essentially the brain's emotional center. And one thing that you'll notice is that memories that are positive in nature or negative in nature are more likely to be remembered than those that are neutral. So when teaching people stuff, having stories that are both positive and negative can be really helpful. Another thing you talked about was dopamine. And this is one of the more important neurotransmitters for learning, reward, movement. There's a few things that dopamine does. It's involved in emotions as well. And what dopamine does is, amongst other things, it gives a sense of reward but it also gets people moving to do what they want to do. So there's this idea that's been thrown around for a long time that you get a dopamine spike after you do something. And that's true. But there's also a dopamine spike preparing to get something that you know you're going to get. So for instance, runners, when they're at the end of their run, they get this runner's high near the end when they realize I can do this, I got this. And it makes people happy, like they can do it. There was a play by a baseball player on the Chicago Cubs a few years ago. His name was Chris Bryant. And he got a grounder hit to him. And he was smiling because he knew that he was going to be able to finish the task and throw it over to first base to get the out to complete the World Series and win. And dopamine is involved in reward, but also in the pursuit of the reward to mobilize resources and to get moving to take care of what's going on. So those are two of the things that I talk about for sure.
I really appreciate that, because when you think about maybe a song playlist, you play the happy song and then you play a song that maybe has like a downbeat. And then Scott Anderle's like, let me talk about that. I'm a rock star, right?
Yeah. And then actually, I want to camp out there for a second, Albrecht, if I can interrupt.
Yeah, let's do it. You're the music expert. I'm not. So that there's science in music, like stage creation, like what you're trying to do with an audience on a stage, right?
Yeah. Oh, and Elliot, you had talked about what I hear you saying with this dopamine kick, a spike that we get first at the end after we've completed the thing, or at the beginning, like you said, with the World Series, when the guy was catching the ball and he already had a smile on his face because he knew where this was going. I really want our listeners to hear Enjoy the Journey. And music, what you were talking about, Albrecht, is you've got a great playlist and you know where these emotions are going. Or like when you start off a concert, you know, by the time you're at the second song at your favorite band, you're feeling the emotion and they haven't even played your favorite song yet, but you know it's going to come. So you're already feeling that dopamine kick. So I totally see how we could, our listeners, hey, you're on the path to leadership right now. And if you have the mindset that I'm going to get this, I'm going to be that leader, is there a dopamine kick that we would get towards enjoying the journey of our pursuit towards a career? Like, could this be spread out through a long term? Because I know the examples we gave are like within a few minutes to a few hours. Is it something that could be a long term effect as well?
Yeah. So what I'd like to focus on here is circling back to motivation. This is the basis of intrinsic motivation, which is finding purpose and meaning and enjoyment in what you do. And this is the type of motivation that can last a really long time relative to external motivation, where it's like, I got to do this to get this raise, or I need to do this to get paid. When you're doing it because you enjoy it, this is something that's sustainable, that lasts a really long time. And that enjoyment that you're getting, that's related to neurotransmitters like dopamine.
Nice, nice.
So as a learning and development specialist, you know, we want to design training in a way that takes them on this emotional roller coaster and try to stay away from the neutral as much as possible. And I want to talk about challenge. So there's an appropriate amount of challenge in which somebody is not in neutral state and they're participating in the thing because of maybe motivation. But then there is a such thing as too much challenge, where you're going over their head and they shut down, and maybe the amygdala is telling them to not cognitively process this very well, and too little challenge, where it's maybe too elemental in nature. So can you tell us about the delicate balance of challenge and its place in learning and development?
Yeah, sure. So when it comes to challenge, it's just about finding the right amount. So with too little, people are bored, they're not applied, they don't find it enjoyable. Intrinsic motivation isn't there because they're not getting that fulfillment from what they're doing. Likely extrinsic motivation isn't there too, because they're not furthering themselves and their job. And then on the other end, it's too much challenge, it's not enjoyable, it's too difficult, nothing's getting done. There's this feeling that people aren't capable, and they kind of lose confidence in themselves. So instead of too much or too little, there's this so-called Goldilocks zone, I'll call it, which is not too hot, not too cold, but just right. And that's where there's an adequate amount of challenge. And this is going to depend on the individual, and it's going to depend on the interests of the individual. And it's going to depend on a whole bunch of stuff, even like time of day. Some people like the challenge early, some people like it later. Some people can focus on a challenge the whole day, some people can't. there's a lot of individual human factors to look into for that.
So one last thing I want to talk about from a learning development specialist standpoint is phased learning spaced over time. So repetition is the key to all learning is what we like to say in training. The more you go to that short-term file, the more you have the chance of it being a long-term file in your brain. Talk about the science behind why you might need to hear something said a different way or said over time, or maybe use a skill multiple times for it to actually stick. Like, can you talk about the science that goes on there?
Yeah, sure. So first I'll start with a story from like some adults I've talked to. They like, for instance, they'll talk about their classes in college and what they remember and what they don't. And this is a story that's pretty common. That's for people that didn't go into, say, like finance, like this group, that where things like econ is really important. So people may have taken econ 101 and gotten an A. And several years later, you ask them what they learned. It's like, you got an A in this really difficult class. You had to use all this complex math. And what they'll tell you is, I remember supply and demand. And that's it, right? And it's just like, wait, you just learned so much. You spent a whole semester. You had an amazing professor. How is that all you remembered, right? And the idea is, when you don't utilize resources that you have for extended periods of time, when you hear things just once and then you let it go, it's more likely to decay than stuff that you frequently use. And the reason for this is based on this idea that every time we do something, our brains change in a small way. This is an idea of neuroplasticity. And what memories are, in essence, are a collection of different neurons that connect to in different ways and influence each other. This is called long-term potentiation. That's the fancy word for it, where one neuron, when it fires, the other one fires. So that the adage is, neurons that fire together wire together. Mm-hmm. And the idea is, things that you practice a bunch are going to be the ones that are least likely to decay over time. That's kind of the basis of it.
Could you explain a little further? So I hear that and I believe it, and I think about it with, let's just use the example of music and see how this would apply to a learning and development role with a student. So I remember songs from like elementary. All right. I listened to them all the time over and over again, but I haven't listened to it in over 10 years. But when that song comes up, I remember it because there. So my question is, there was repetition when I was younger, but in the past 10 years, I haven't listened to it at all. How does that still stick with me, and why, and how could we apply that to training our team?
It helps that you're 20 years old. So, you know, it does help that you're infinitely youthful, Scott Anderley.
Yeah. So let me take this a step further. So I work with individuals with dementia, and I have friends that study this. They study music and memory. And a common finding is that even very far along in the Alzheimer's process, where like individuals aren't able to take care of their daily needs, their memory for new events is quite poor. Songs from their youth are often what remain with it's like almost 100% of the time. So much so that it is a potential way to mitigate issues that people have during the end of the day with like emotional dysregulation. So these musical memories that remain are a way to regulate emotions for individuals with dementia. And the idea is, how come these musical memories are so strong?
Yeah.
And when you think about it, you've probably listened to the songs a bunch of times, but then also these songs are tied into other memories, different things that were happening during different points of your life. And these kind of connections make them really strong as well. And when you think about music, in a lot of ways, it's a way of like making emotion out of sound. And because of that, it sticks really well in the brain.
You'd say it resonates.
Yeah. Say that. I like that.
So D-A-N-V-A-N. Let's go super nerdy. Like, let's just jump into the pool of like, you're talking about networks connecting to each other and staying connected, and maybe not, like maybe they decay. I love the use of the word decay there. So for our nuclear science friends, you know what that means. But yeah, talk about the role of DAN, Dan, and VAN, Van, as we're talking about neural networks connecting and firing and having connections or not, right?
Sure. Yeah. So let me kind of take a step back and explain what's going on. So whenever you want to learn stuff, the first thing you have to do is like perceptually look and listen at what's happening. And then the next step is whether or not you're able to pay attention to what's going on. And these acronyms, VAN and DAN, they're different attentional networks, right? So the dorsal attentional network is DAN. And what its job is what's called top-down attention, which is to be able to focus on specific goals and ignore distractions. So it's two pieces. One, you have to select what it is that you want to, and then also be able to inhibit things that you don't want to. So say you're at a coffee shop, you want to be able to read what you're reading, but not listen in to everybody else's conversation, right? This is the dorsal network. So dorsal is, in anatomy, it means on top. So if you think of a dolphin, its dorsal fin is on the top, right? Whereas ventral means underneath. So it's a network that's below. And this network is tied in closely with the amygdala. And what's job is called bottom-up attention. And it grabs your attention when there's something that stands out, when there's something that's threatening, and it's able to pull your attention away so that when you're at the bookshop or you're at the coffee shop and you're studying, if something really alarming happens, you'd be able to disengage from what you're doing and defend yourself if the case needed to be, right? So that's a look at these two attentional networks and how they work together. And in an ideal world, kind of one is working at a time and they kind of switch depending on circumstance.
We talk about this idea of important and urgent. So from what you just said, this dorsal attention network, Albrecht, if I'm correct, and what we teach, this would be, we need to focus on, those are the important tasks. These are the things that they're specific goals and we ignore distractions. We are focused on this. But then it's also important for us to have this VAN, the ventral below what you kind of said, survival. And we talk about this with the urgent needs. Maybe there's a irate member that walks in. Maybe there's some technology that's not working that we need to get fixed really quick. So I'm hearing this and you said they kind of alternate of what's, you know, if you're more in the DAN phase or more in the VAN phase. My question is, how can we train ourselves to get better at VAN if I'm lean more towards a DAN, like if my strength is more at that DAN, the dorsal attention network?
Yeah. So our brains are wired in different ways based on life experiences. So in general, most of the issues actually emerge from the other way, where people struggle to focus and the dorsal attentional network isn't as active. And that could be seen in things like ADD or ADHD, where people are often distracted by different sounds and different things that pop up. This is also common in individuals that are high in things like anxiety, where they're more likely to kind of like jump at something that might happen. I'd say in general, the ventral attentional stream, the one that's involved in like danger processing, it's so deeply intertwined with our biological being that typically that one doesn't misfunction very often. It's rare for that to be the case. There's individuals that have individual differences in their brain, and there hasn't been to my knowledge, a study on specific individuals with issues in that network. But let me give an example of one that probably has less activation than others. Have either of you seen the movie Free Solo, where Alex Arnold, and he's an amazing climber, right? And he's able to climb these huge mountains, El Capitan in Yosemite, without any ropes or anything, something that would just scare, you know, just about anybody, to the point where being so scared would paralyze them and they wouldn't be able to do what they have to do. So for him, his ventral attentional network likely isn't as active as in someone else, because when they did an fMRI and they looked at activation of the amygdala, which is involved in fear, it was less active than the typical baseline control subject, than the average population, which makes sense. And it's actually really adaptive in what he does to not feel as scared, because that could hamper him and make him do worse. So if you think about daredevils, like say like Evel Knievel, if in the middle of the backflip he started freaking out and being concerned, it could have messed him up. You either have to do it or not do it, right? Mm-hmm. So there's some circumstances where being able to inhibit that is really important. But there's also circumstances where that can save you too. You're walking down the street and you're jumping out of the way because a car is coming.
Yeah. Right? So What I'm hearing you say is there's no specific practice to develop these skills. They're kind of natural born attributes. You might be a little lower on the
van. To some extent.
So for a dorsal attentional stream, there's some things that you can do that might help. So like one would be to focus on mindfulness meditation. So being able to focus in on breath work, you're actually training your attentional systems to focus on certain things and try your best to ignore distractions. So like that could be a way to work on attentional like focus and control.
Nice. Thanks, Elliot. That was really, really exciting stuff.
Yeah. So we're going to pivot to the learner.
Yeah.
So, cause some of the people that listen to this podcast are training and development specialists like us, or they're purchasing material from us and now they know that we care about it actually working. So that's good. But many are, they're learners, right? And they're going to go to a class or a webinar or a training that we do. And I want to take what you just said and expound upon it. So in athletics, you put yourself through stressful situations like maybe a sauna and an ice bath, and you use breath to control what you have in your control. Because when you get out into a football field or soccer field or whatever sport you're playing, you have no control over the weather. You have no control over what the other team's going to do. Sometimes you don't have control over what your own body's going to do. You might cramp up. But how you react in that moment, you have control over. You can control your controllables. And so they put themselves into saunas and ice baths and use breathing as a technique to prepare themselves for the unknown by controlling the controllables. So on that note, like, how should a learner prepare for something that they know is a huge investment in them, something that they know if they pay good attention to it could set them up for a great career? What are some of those things that they can do that are hacks, learning and development hacks that help their brain be focused for that session?
Yeah, sure. So yeah, I say in general, the kind of adage is practice makes perfect, but in reality, it's practice and sleep make perfect. So during sleep, there's a few really important things that happen. One is this is a part where memories are consolidated. When you talked earlier about short-term storage to long-term storage, that's what memory consolidation is. And then also during sleep, your brain has methods to kind of clean itself out so it functions at a kind of better for the next few days. So practice and sleep are the places to start. But then it's all about trying to figure out how to use this information in real life. So For the story with friends, parents, if they were looking at ways to apply what they learned in econ, they would have definitely kept up with it if they were reading those different sections, right? But because they didn't, they forgot it. So it's all about figuring out a way to apply it to your life. Things that are relevant to you are way more likely to be remembered than things that aren't. And things that you can just connect to different areas of your life are going to be the ones that stick around the longest. So it's about applying it to yourself. It's about getting good sleep. It's about being able to focus. There's a lot of different pieces, but it's coming in with that mindset that you're hoping to bring in and improve. And if you can find a way to make it meaningful to you and your life, and you can get intrinsic motivation and extrinsic motivation, then you're setting yourself up to succeed.
So what I heard you say, I'm going to unpack this a little bit.
Sure.
If I ask myself, what is it that I'd like to learn from this training? Then I actually am already setting myself up for a greater chance of success.
Right.
If I ask myself, what do I already know about this topic? And how does this topic relate to me? That actually I'm creating a connection that makes it a longer tail connection than if I go into a training blind being like, you know, this could help me, it could not help me. I'm just the mindset going in can actually impact the learning. Is that correct?
Oh yeah, 100%. So like it's on the learner, but it's also on the teacher to sell that like this information is important. It's going to help you and explain exactly how it can be. And it's very much on the onus of the company to figure out a way to put people in spots where that they could utilize this information. And hopefully, like the ideal is that they can use it in a creative way with some sort of autonomy. If you let people run off with it and use creativity, then all of a sudden it becomes really fun and it becomes a product that people make that they can be proud of. And that's really the end goal. If everything works out, that's what it looks like.
that takes a lot of proper planning on the front end, so it doesn't run off in a course that doesn't help.
Right. Motor, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
You define what this topic is. So no, I think that's the point of this podcast is, you know, learning and development. I can go and sit in front of an audience and spew what I know, but when it's not designed well, it can backfire. It could be a waste of time, a waste of money. I'd love to hear what keeps you up at night. You know so much about this, and it's your job to teach people, things at Miami University. What are some of those things that you want to get right as a professor?
Yeah, I think that really motivation is the start of it. So let me give you an example of some things that are going on in my classes and how I'm trying to solve them. So as time has gone on, there's been more of a preference towards online learning through a variety of different factors that have happened and are continuing to happen in the world, right? And it just leads to more independence for individuals. They can work during the day. It fits a lot of schedules better. So anyway, online learning is becoming bigger. And I've been trying to figure out ways to make the information more entertaining. So I've been working on gamifying what I've been doing. So I've been working on creating like animations and skits in my classes and applying it to real world situations. So one example of this is I teach adult development and aging, cognitive neuroscience. And everything that we learn in the class is applied to this older adult's home in this kind of gamified cartoon world. And it's making what they're learning important and shown that it can be applied in a way that can be helpful, not only to them, but you can share this knowledge with older adults to make their life better. So it's creating kind of like a narrative and kind of like a story and displaying how what they're learning is important and has a place in the world.
As someone who's narrated a cartoon and written a children's book for financial wellness, I've played with the animation and it's fun, man. When you make a little animated human being, it's a good time, man. So I'm glad that you're doing your thing there. Any final words to the leaders of the Credit Union Leadership Podcast on learning and development and using the brain to its max extent?
Yeah. Great question. I think that it's all about mindset, coming in with wanting to learn, making things as relevant as possible, making sure that people realize that this is actually important information they can use. Because once people can run off with the information and make it their own, that's the dream. So figuring out a way to kind of let your employees run with it and continue to learn is the major goal.
Albrecht, what were some of the big key takeaways for you from our talk today?
Yeah, so the brain doesn't work too well if there is no reason for it to work. So the amygdala is like a kind of a triggering van vehicle that allows the hippocampus to get some blood and potentially get some short-term and long-term memory stored. And you also have dopamine spikes coming from the DAN to get things done, and that motivation either to save your life or to stay focused. Both of those motivations are key. Tying whatever it is that you're learning to something that you've learned in the past, something that you hope to learn in the future, or something that is applicable to your life is a mindset that you can come into a training with as a learner. It's also questions you can pose as a learning and development specialist to activate these amygdala and hippocampus responses to give your learners the best chance at learning something. The amount of challenge needs to be appropriate enough to get the Goldilocks zone. And I really like that we talked about phased learning spaced over time, so that repetition, going back and repeating a skill, keeping yourself abreast of the economics is the example he used, is one of the ways in which you can get that to last and sleep. So
yeah.
for a new parent who got 4 hours of sleep last night, I'm guessing he's got some covetousness and some envy over the sleep piece.
Yeah.
But it is 100% in the control of the learner to get a really good night's rest after a training. That's when the filing process is done, is before and after a training, you get a really good night's of rest. And that gives your brain the best chance of retaining the information.